May it please the court, I'm Paul Gordon on behalf of General Steele and Jeffrey Knight. We're asking this court to reverse the trial court on what was essentially a summary judgment ruling, or in the alternative, the court ruled that certain events implemented this court's Division 6's mandate from an earlier appeal in this case. And that makes four issues on appeal, and we submit that the trial court erred on all four issues. The first I would like to address is the waiver issue. The trial court ruled that General Steele waived its right to consequential damages, notwithstanding the fact that the Division 6 had ordered that they would be permitted to pursue consequential damages. And I recognize that you're familiar with the facts, but because this is a summary judgment issue, I think there's certain facts I have to discuss. And I want to read a couple of sentences which constitute the conduct that supposedly was a waiver during the arbitration. Now, what happened is you have to understand that the trial court had ruled that General Steele was not entitled to consequential damages, and then certified that issue for appeal pursuant to Rule 54. And simultaneously, there was a Rule 54 appeal and the arbitration going on. So this is what happens in the arbitration that is supposedly the waiver. In a motion to amend the counterclaims, General Steele states, at the time General Steele submitted their original answer, Judge Stern had not issued his order clarifying which claims he had certified for appeal pursuant to Rule 54. Accordingly, General Steele sought to preserve their rights by seeking broader relief in this arbitration. Now that Judge Stern has clarified the claims that General Steele is pursuing in the Rule 54 appeal and will be able to litigate in district court if they prevail on that appeal, General Steele is able to limit their request for relief in this arbitration to the return of legal fees that had been paid to Hogan and Hartson. I would submit to you that there's nothing more clear in that language than their intent to preserve their claim for consequential damages. And the test here on summary judgment standards is that Hogan and Hartson had the burden of proof to prove beyond doubt an intent to waive the right to consequential damages. This act of clarifying the claims in the arbitration was articulated in such a way as to preserve the claims, not waive them. And for that reason, I submit the trial court erred in the first issue.
Mr. Gordon, even assuming all of what you just said to be the case, what about the later reassertion of the claim several days before the arbitration hearing?
And I have that language. It is slightly different, and it is not exactly what everybody has said it has been. They did not come back in on the eve of of the hearing itself and say, we want to assert consequential damages. What they said was, we want to assert legal fees, and we think those legal fees should include legal fees paid to successor counsel, which was Perkins Coie. And so I'll read to you the very language that they used, paraphrasing the numbers they used. They said, in what was a tantamount to a trial brief, it was the hearing arbitration brief, they said, here, General Steele paid $800,000 to claimant. That would be Hogan and Hartson. General Steele paid another $500,000 to Perkins Coie between August of 2004 and December of 2004. General Steele is entitled to recover all damages caused by claimant's wrongful conduct, including some or all of the fees paid to claimant and or Perkins Coie's attorney's fees. And then it goes on to have some generalized language, none of which says consequential damages in general. So first off, when you actually look at what they did not attempt to reassert all claims for consequential damages. And to understand that, you need to understand two things. One is, the way Judge Stern phrased his order mandating arbitration was this. He, at the very end of his order limiting arbitration, he says, therefore, plaintiff's damages under their breach of contract claim are limited to recovery of legal fees. He did not say, you can't get consequential damages. He said, legal fees. And I only clarified that so that you understand what happens on the eve of the arbitration hearing, which is General Steele then attempts to expand the definition of legal fees as it was used by Judge Stern in the first instance. But let's assume for the sake of discussion that the claims the fees paid to Perkins Coie are in fact a kind of consequential damages. It still doesn't constitute an effort on their part to reinstate all consequential damages. Because in this case, the big enchilada, if you will, for consequential damages was the increase in the amount of money they had to pay in order to settle the claims against them in the first place. To use an extreme example that might help clarify this, what if you're charged with a crime and the maximum sentence is a year and you have a chance to plead out for 90 days? But your lawyer fails to assert a defense that your lawyer promised to assert, contractually promised to assert, and your lawyer fails to stamp your case the way your lawyer contractually promised to stamp your case. And as a result, you're now facing a 15-year sentence, and you have to compromise that, and you agree to 4.5 years in prison. Our Supreme Court has ruled in Rance that you don't have to prove you're innocent to prove that you've been damaged by legal malpractice in a criminal case. Well, this is not a criminal case. These were disputed charges against General Steele, and General Steele vigorously and aggressively disputed them. But as a practical matter, the case that they were exposed to was only a $1 million case before Hogan and Hartson failed the staff and failed to perform their promises. And then it became a $15 million case. And so the main consequential damages here is not the attorney's fees claim, but it's the claim for having to pay an extra $4.5 million to settle the case, which is in fact what they ended up having to pay. So they did not attempt, shortly before the eve of the arbitration hearing, to assert a claim for all consequential damages. Another category of consequential damages, there's only one case I can find in the country to recognize it, but I would submit that it's a real consequential damage, which is all the copycat litigation that they're having to deal with in light of what happened when Hogan and Hartson breached its contracts. So that was yet an entirely different category of consequential damages they did not attempt to assert on the eve of the arbitration. So I would submit to you, Your Honor, that the issue that is addressed by this conduct 3 days before the hearing is whether or not the arbitrator in fact had an opportunity to implement the mandate. And did they, had the arbitrator already implemented the mandate? And when you look at what the arbitrator was actually doing, both in terms of the language of the pre-hearing brief 3 days before and in terms of the scope of the arbitrator's authority as articulated by the trial court, it's apparent that the arbitrator never reached the issue of consequential damages and never could have. Another one of the arguments they're trying to make here is that somehow General Steele voluntarily entered into a contract to allow for the consequential damages claim to be asserted by in the arbitration. But there's no language creating such a contract, there's no quid pro quo, and there's no logic to doing that.
But weren't there some claims that originally had been dismissed by the trial court, such as the fraudulent concealment and other tort-based claims, that the arbitrator allowed to be essentially pled in the arbitration?
Well, they were pled, but I don't recall them actually being litigated.
Well, the arbitrator, as I recall the record, actually ruled on the merits that those claims were not valid. They would not prevail. So doesn't that indicate that they were in fact tried?
Well, I'm not remembering the specific detail, I have to admit. I will say, though, that even if there were other claims that were specifically tried, most clearly the consequential damage claim was not tried. And that's the claim that's on appeal here. So while it is true that they could have accidentally de facto walked their way into a contract to litigate the consequential damage claim, they didn't do that. And much has been made of the fact that Hogan and Hartson did some things that would seem to have been an affirmation or ratification, not necessarily an express acceptance of a contract, but some kind of post hoc ratification of the intent to litigate consequential damages. Why wouldn't they? They already had a ruling from the trial court that General Steele would not be permitted to get consequential damages. So there was no downside to them to making the discovery choices that they made. It doesn't rise to the level of a contract with consideration to submit to the arbitrator a prayer for relief that they had vigorously, at every step of the process, attempted to keep out of arbitration. I have 5 minutes, and so I want to jump ahead to the foreseeability issue. The only difference between foreseeability in a contract context and a foreseeability in a tort context is the moment in time at which you assess the foreseeability. And what happened in this case is the judge ruled that it was not foreseeable that mistakes would get made by these attorneys. But it was foreseeable, and it was foreseeable at the time they entered the contract. In fact, the very purpose of the contract, the way they articulated it, the idea of having an experienced litigator handle the case, was that they would anticipate that there would be mistakes made by an inexperienced litigator. So I can't imagine, and I've said in the briefs, and I'll say it again, I don't understand what the point would be of hiring an experienced litigator if it isn't that you are anticipating and concerned about the experience that a junior associate might make, which is what happened in this case. There were mistakes made by an inexperienced attorney, an attorney that was not supposed to be handling that hearing, and the defendants had contractually promised to have somebody else, a more experienced litigator, handle that hearing. And so the breach of contract and the damages that took place are the most foreseeable, the very type of foreseeable damages that could have been expected at the time of contract. So I have 3 minutes left, and I would like to reserve the balance of my time.
Please, the court. My name is Harold Haddon, registration number 1297. I appear on behalf of Hogan and Hartson. I think that 2 points ought to be stressed at the beginning because they sort of inform the rest of my argument. The first is that this case comes to this court on summary judgment where the plaintiffs filed no evidentiary material in opposition. So the record on this summary judgment has no material facts in dispute. And as a footnote, Judge Casebolt, you were correct that all of the substantive tort claims which were dismissed by the district court on motion to dismiss were resurrected in the arbitration and were litigated to a final arbitration award. So I submit that with respect to the question of whether there are any material undisputed facts, there is no question. And the second sort of highlight point that I think Mr. Gordon also affirmed in his argument is that there are four separate independent bases for affirmance of the summary judgment award. I'll address each of them in a summary way and happy to take your questions along the way. The first and really the core question is whether or not what happened in the arbitration did in fact fulfill the mandate of this court in its 2010 decision. And what we endeavored to do after the case got back to the district court is to bring before the district court all of the arbitration record, which had not gone to this court in the first appeal, and it couldn't have gone to this court in the first appeal because the arbitration was confirmed by the district court, judgment was entered on it without objection by General Steele. And under those circumstances, and under an express order of this court, the arbitration record was not considered by this court in the first appeal. So when the mandate came down from the first appeal, the mandate fairly read directs that General Steele should have a full and fair opportunity to litigate consequential damages. Our assessment was that we had to have the arbitration record before the district court and this court so that the court could appreciate that General Steele did, in fact, have a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue and, in fact, did so. Did so first by asserting in very broad categories of consequential damages, and then asking for discovery, extensive discovery, which Hogan and Hartson provided, discovery such as the designation and identity of witnesses on issues which included, expressly included, the very broad consequential damage claim that General Steele again asserts in this appeal, that the existence of Judge Jackson's order caused General Steele great damage. So Hogan and Hartson provided not just preliminary disclosures, but also an extensive mountain of documentary evidence, all of which was responsive to General Steele's discovery request on the issue of damages as well as liability. And the record on this is also clear, after that discovery was provided, General Steele assessed it, and at that point, filed a motion to limit its damage claims and said that the reason it was doing so was to, quote, streamline discovery and provide for a more expedited arbitration hearing. There was no statement then or ever in this record that General Steele was trying to preserve its record for this appeal. You can search the record in vain for any such statement or disclaimer, if you will. That simply was never asserted by General Steele in any of the proceedings before the arbitrator. And in fact, if General Steele, as it claimed in arguments before the district court, was confused about whether or not the arbitrator had authority, it was a very simple expedient to determine whether the arbitrator had that authority. Arbitrator has, in this jurisdiction, in almost all jurisdictions, the authority to determine her own jurisdiction. What General Steele did, frankly, was try to have several bites at the damage apple. It asserted broad damage claims. It looked at the discovery, decided that it did not want to try the case within a case, which would be necessary to establish that Judge Jackson's order was the consequence of Mr. Cobb not attending the status conference that formed the breach of Hogan's contract. They decided that essentially would, before the arbitrator, result in another fraud trial, much like the trial before Judge Jackson. And so they made a conscious decision to limit their damages after seeing discovery. And then, as Your Honor had noted from the record, on the eve of arbitration, attempted to reassert a fairly broad category of consequential damages, and not just Perkins and Coolidge fees, which is a measure of consequential and not direct damage, but also in the same pleading, as Judge Stern noted in his summary judgment order, also again protested the damage that had flowed from the, quote, very existence of Judge Jackson's order. That under the law constitutes a waiver. The decisions of this court are clear that waiver is not always a jury issue. It can and has been decided on summary judgment when the facts are clear, and they are clear and undisputed in this case. It also constitutes claim preclusion, and claim preclusion in this case is uniquely appropriate because the parties were the same. All the claims were at one point in time presented to the arbitrator, General Steele going back and forth on its damage claims, but otherwise litigating all of its contract claims, litigating liability for breach of contract, and litigating a variety of damage claims. And so the only issue that I see that General Steele has raised in terms of the applicability of claim preclusion on this appeal has to do with the so-called element of finality, one of the four elements that is required for claim preclusion. And the argument, as I apprehend it from reading General Steele's brief, is that the arbitrator's award was never final. It is somehow still before this court, and because there was no finality, there's no claim preclusion. The problem with that argument, the fundamental problem with that argument, is that General Steele, when we moved to certify the arbitration award and we asked Judge Stern to enter judgment on that award, General Steele made no objection at all to certifying and entering judgment on the arbitration award, and among other things, never objected to the arbitrator's authority to hear the damage claims and the liability claim that she did in fact hear and render an award on. So on those facts, there was certainly finality with respect to the arbitration award, which was never appealed, and became final. And there's a 1975 decision of this court called Flournoy versus Sales, which is right on point on the issue of finality of one aspect of litigation, while another aspect of the litigation is appealed on a separate track. That's exactly what happened here. There was an arbitration. There was an award entered on the arbitration without objection, and a appeal proceeded on a separate track, and this is an unfortunate track two of that appeal on the judge's motion to dismiss, but there really were separate proceedings, and there was clearly and is clearly finality with respect to the arbitration award. So we submit that that is a plain case of claim preclusion here. I'll spend a couple of minutes talking about foreseeability, which counsel raised in his first argument. The district judge and we had great difficulty determining exactly what damages General Steele claimed were left in this case after the arbitration, and especially what damages could be deemed reasonably foreseeable on the record of this case. General Steele filed nothing in opposition to our summary judgment motion, and the key piece of evidence that Hogan and Hartson filed in support of summary judgment was Judge Jackson's order, because the constant complaint that we have heard from General Steele is that the core of its damage claim has to do with the quote, the very existence of Judge Jackson's order, which, according to General Steele in arguments, although never supported by evidence, caused General Steele to settle for more than it would have otherwise, caused, as Mr. Gordon just argued, copycat litigation, a whole variety of damages that they hypothesized but had not supported with any evidence. The best evidence of whether or not Judge Jackson's order, finding in great detail General Steele guilty of a massive consumer fraud, the very best evidence of that is Judge Jackson's order. After the Hogan and Hartson breach of contract, where lead counsel failed to attend the status conference, after that there was extensive discovery. Lead counsel at Hogan was replaced by a very capable attorney named Bob Miller from Perkins Coie, and there was a two-week trial on the merits, all after the breach of contract that the arbitrator found against Hogan and Hartson. And it was capably litigated. There's been really no evidence or even argument about that. It was fully litigated. Judge Jackson, in a very comprehensive and able opinion, found that General Steele and its president had committed massive consumer fraud. And in its very detailed factual findings, also found that there should be not just a maximum in terms of civil penalties, but also damages. And then the case was set over for another 3 years while they litigated further damage claims.
Chair Haddon, as I understand the theory, though, it is that had the representation gone as proposed in the representation agreement, the discovery, the breadth of discovery would have been significantly different, because the trial court in Judge Jackson, now I'm speaking about, would not have pursued or allowed nationwide discovery, is the phrase I've seen. What's your position on that?
Judge Jackson, after extensive briefing following the status conference, did allow nationwide discovery.
That was because it was stipulated, was it not?
No. There was a proposed stipulation for nationwide discovery. After that, briefs were filed about the propriety of one, nationwide discovery, and two, nationwide remedies. Judge Jackson, after that, entered orders and ultimately entered a final trial order, concluding that nationwide discovery and nationwide remedies were appropriate. But those were fully litigated after the status conference. At the status conference, Mr. Gallagher proposed that he would stipulate, if his clients agreed, to nationwide discovery, because he wanted, and this is in the record, he wanted to defer Judge Jackson's determination that there ought to be nationwide remedies. After that, there was further briefing. Judge Jackson ultimately determined that both the nationwide discovery and nationwide remedies were appropriate, and indeed he confirmed that in his 42-page order, where he finds liability and then he sets it over for further proceedings on damages other than those which he ordered in the initial case. So I see my time's up, and I won't belabor it further, except to say that that it was in fact litigated, and Judge Jackson did in fact hold, after contested hearings, that nationwide discovery and nationwide remedies were appropriate. I thank you very much for your time.
May it please the court, I wish to emphasize something that was different about the claims that may have been reasserted in the arbitration and the prayer for consequential damages. Judge Stern had ruled as a matter of substantive law that General Steele was not entitled to consequential damages. So even if as a matter of procedural law they had reasserted it, they couldn't get them, which is why it would never have been their intent to pursue it in an arbitration, knowing that the arbiter was prohibited from awarding those damages.
Well, if that's true, Mr. Gordon, why did the arbitrator allow these tort claims to be reasserted? That's the same ruling, isn't it? Judge Stern said you can't recover on those tort-based claims.
I don't think that's correct in terms of what Judge Stern was saying. Judge Stern was saying because it's barred by the statute of limitations and it's just it's the same thing. What he's saying is that as a matter of substantive law, you can't do an end around the statute of limitations. And the Court of Appeals comes along and says, no, you can have consequential damages caused by negligence and you can have consequential damages caused by tort. Just because they might be caused by both doesn't mean you're barred from that prayer for relief. He does. What he's not talking about, which Judge Stern is not saying, is that as a matter of substantive law, you can't get, and I don't remember what these other claims were that might have been re-added in the arbitration. Two more points. A lot of emphasis, once again, has been placed on Judge Jackson's order. But Judge Jackson's order was we submit wrong, first off, and second off, the case was settled shortly after that order. As a result, they didn't get the opportunity to have it fully litigated in the sense that they didn't get the opportunity to go up on appeal and have it challenged, much the way Judge Stern's order was reversed in the first instance, and we submit that it should be reversed in the second instance. So the mere fact that the order exists causes damages, not the least of which is that they're facing $15 million. But that doesn't make the Judge Jackson's order correct. And I would submit to you, it was a terribly wrong order. And it's terribly unfair in legal malpractice cases to punish a client for an outcome that is the direct product of a breach of contract by the lawyer.
Agree with you that Judge Jackson's order was wrong and that a reasonably competent trial judge would have gone the other way?
No. Two things. First off, even if a reasonably competent trial judge is wrong, there can be malpractice. The case escapes me at the moment. But you can have malpractice with multiple causes, one cause being a mistake made by a lawyer, and then a second cause being a mistake made by a judge. So we don't have to prove that the judge was wrong, per se, but we will prove, I think we will actually do what you're asking. Your question was, do we have to? I think we will actually do it, which is, we will be able to prove the Judge Jackson order was, in fact, wrong as a result. We just don't have to. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.